Welcome to this month's City Talks. My guest today is Simon Parker, Director of Local Government Think Tank NLGN, and the author of Taking Power Back, Putting People in Charge of Politics. It's a great book, and I really do encourage listeners to read it. And the book addresses a key issue facing Britain and many other countries across the globe. Now, where should power and responsibility lie? Simon, before we get into the detail of the answer to this question, can you start by setting out how and why we find ourselves in the position that we do? That Britain is an incredibly centralised country, politically, economically, some say culturally as well. In fact, one of the most, if not the most, centralised countries, certainly in the OECD and maybe even in the world. How did we get there? Because in the book, you quite clearly show that we weren't always this very centralised country, and it's come about over the last 30, 40, 50 years. So give us that history and the thinking behind it.
Well, I think it's a really important point. It's one of the starting points for the book, really, is, you know, you go back to the 1930s and Britain is one of the most decentralised countries in the world. We have a very strong history of cities driving social progress. You know, one of the details I came across from the 19th century was that Gladstone was so keen to avoid taking control of city finances that when he needed to put more money into local public services, he actually hypothecated alcohol duty and gave that to the cities. So that his government wouldn't have anything to do with it. Yeah. He actually kept his hands off it. And you see, in particularly the 20s and 30s, this incredibly innovative development of labour inner cities, places like Bermondsey, in London, the London County Council, developing the basics of what we now think is the welfare state. So one of the stories I tell in the book is about the Salters, Alfred Nader, in Bermondsey, who were elected in the early 1920s. And on this tiny postage stamp of an authority, it's very small, it's very poor, based around the Surrey docks. They built basic health services, they bought a convalescent home in the country for women who'd have babies, they sent people to Switzerland for solar treatment, they built a playground, they sent these vans around teaching people about public health, these cinemotor vans, which were powered from the streetlights and had slideshows in them. It's extraordinary. And they did this off local resources. By the time you hit the 30s, the London County Council is running the rudiments of a health service. About 70% of hospital beds in London are run by the London County Council. Mm-hmm. It's far from perfect, don't get me wrong, and we shouldn't lionise the 20s and 30s too much. But given the resources they had, and given the lack of national support for a lot of what they were doing, what these places achieved was extraordinary. And I think, you know, if you were someone like a William Beveridge looking at the world from the mid-1930s and dreaming of your future welfare state, you'd have probably expected that to develop. And actually, when you look at the development of the National Health Service in the later 30s, the early 40s, for a very long time, that's what's expected. Mm. Labour goes to the 1945 election planning to expand municipal healthcare systems. That was its policy. But what happens when Labour comes into power, of course, is the first great wave of centralism. And Bevan does his deal with the doctors. Energy is nationalised. That was a big part of what local government did. I think in the book I list, I think it's something like Lincolnshire County Council. And they had about 14 committees dealing with different services. I think only about four of those committees were left properly independent after Labour had finished. Yeah. And there was this huge wave of centralisation. Now, you know, let's put that in context. Local government still raised most of its own money. A lot of the powers that went were replaced with huge powers of housing and urban development through the Town and Country Planning Act.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of what councils had lost in terms of public services was replaced in terms of this huge power just to reshape the urban fabric of Britain. And we know in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, that was extraordinary. So, you know, local government takes a big hit, and arguably that results in better public services. There is a backlash, of course. I mean, what happens almost immediately after Labour implements its plans are people like Michael Young, people like Richard Crossman, even Tony Crosland start saying, well, hang on, you know, we've put more money in people's pockets and that's good, but we wanted the moral regeneration of Britain.
Yeah.
You know, and we haven't done that. We've created these kind of big impersonal systems. And that happens almost immediately. And that really feeds into the new left and the emergence of the new left, particularly in the 70s. You know, and you have people on the new left, the LSE, saying, you know, public services are a bad advertisement for socialism because they are impersonal, because they're bossy, over-professionalised. And that really then feeds into, I think, the second wave of centralism, which really comes in the 80s. And that's the battle between the new left in local government and Thatcher.
And this was mainly the bigger metropolitan county councils, as it was in London and Greater Manchester and West Midlands, West Yorks as well. Or was it more broader than that, local versus central?
Well, when it came to rate capping specifically, it was a bit more mixed. There were even some conservative authorities who were rate cap rebels. Right. People forget that. There were one or two conservative authorities that initially refused to set a rate. Not many.
Yeah.
But the real battle, as I think you've hinted, you know, it's Sheffield, it's Merseyside, of course, less so Manchester, and it's London authorities like Lambeth.
Mm.
And I guess I'm quite critical of that generation in the book, because while I kind of recognise their idealism, I think a big part of the problem, and we're seeing this playing out in contemporary politics, is I think figures like, certainly people like Ted Knight, to a lesser extent, Blunkett, to a lesser extent, Ken Livingston, they came to see local government as a battering ram to try and bring down Margaret Thatcher. And Livingston always says it explicitly. I've quoted him in the book. He says, you know, let no one be any doubt the GLC is now a stronghold of the Labour movement, and we will have a holding pattern until a left-wing Labour government can be elected.
Mm.
And there was this kind of slightly revolutionary politics in which local government became less about what the Salters had done with it, which was trying to do useful things in adverse conditions. And it became, we are going to bring down the government and these councils will be our tool. Now, the reason I'm critical of that is because I think that's a fight that a local authority can never win.
Mm.
You know, in a unitary state, Thatcher was in charge. She picked a fight. She beat them. And you see just the sheer extent of the collapse of the municipal left after Thatcher wins. You know, what we see over the sort of the 10 years from 1985, we see council tax capped,
yeah,
universally, really held down,
mm,
the business rate nationalised, the end practically of council housing, the housing revenue account nationalised, this gigantic wave of centralism which then carries straight on into the Blair era. And a lot of people in the Blair era, so people like Paul Kirby, who ran a big part of the Audit Commission, they were onlookers to the madness,
yeah,
in the 80s and the early 90s. And unsurprisingly, they didn't have a lot of time for it.
No.
So we end up with kind of Thatcher neutering local government, followed by the Blair-Brown era, in which Labour politicians had no faith at all in the capacity of local government because of their own experience of it. And then you sort of hit now, and all of a sudden, you know, you get into 2010, and, you know, organisations like yours, like mine, start saying, well, hang on, you know, there's nowhere further to go. You know, by 2010, it was hard to see what else you could possibly centralise.
Yeah.
You know, there was just no further to go. And you could see the results. You know, a good example I think I use in the book is around the child poverty target. Now, you know, that's exactly the right target. Of course we should be seeking to end child poverty. But you see Blair standing up and announcing this moral crusade. We're not going to have poor kids in this country. Now, that's an opportunity for a social movement. That's an opportunity to engage people, to enthuse people, to have community groups, social enterprises, local government involved.
Mm.
But typical Blairism, what it becomes is a series of tweaks to the benefit system. It becomes a technocratic top-down exercise, and unsurprisingly, the target's missed in 2010. Of course, progress is made, but the target isn't hit, and it seems likely now that we'll never hit it. And I just think, you know, we've ended up with this system which is extraordinarily top-down, which for some reason we've convinced ourselves, particularly people on the left have convinced themselves, that central control somehow means that we're tackling poverty, that we're delivering equality.
Mm.
Well, we aren't. It's quite obvious we aren't. The NHS is one of the most centralised systems in the known universe. And yet, our health inequalities are scandalous. They're higher than they were during the Depression. You know, you look at levels of wealth inequality in this country. We have some of the highest levels of wealth inequality in Europe. Now, you know, we have those while still being one of the most centralised countries,
yeah,
in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, go to Denmark, go to Sweden, go to Germany, the Netherlands. All of these countries are more decentralised. All of them are more equal. And yet we still have people, even this week, I've been invited to an event to talk about how localism and tackling poverty are incompatible. I just looked at that and I thought, well, hang on. As far as I can see, centralism and tackling poverty have been incompatible. So, you know, why are we giving centralism a free pass?
Yeah. I'm like you, you know, in many conversations, I'm always struck by, you know, the sort of defence of the status quo, and that somehow what we have now is ideal, and you, like us, you know, you go to different parts of the country. It's very hard to, you know, to make a credible case that, you know, Blackpool or Burnley or Hastings or, you know, Plymouth do well out of a very centralised system. And yet that's constantly, you know, the case that's always made to us. And I'm, you know, you hear that as much as it has. One of the interesting ideas when you're talking through the history of how Britain became incredibly centralised, you talk a little bit about the significance and the influence of the empire and some of the thinking there and how that was almost brought back to onshore. Just say a little bit more about, you know, what that meant for you and how that plays out.
That's a thought I sort of half developed, I think, in the book.
I think it's a great thought.
One of my good friends, a guy called John Wilson, is writing a book about the Raj at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the introduction, one of his sub-themes is about the way that centrism drives people mad. And his view was, you know, that the Raj was his attempt by kind of British bureaucrats, really, to manage this gigantic subcontinent with this tiny government, which couldn't possibly hope to really reach out and control what was happening. And I suspect where he's going with it, because I've read other people make this argument, is that when India regained its independence, you know, what happened was that it also inherited those very centralised structures, and those have been a problem for the subcontinent for some time. You know, what we saw with the empire was a system which was quite centrally controlled, where people were used to being in control of these big national systems abroad. All those people come home. And I guess my argument in the book, which I suppose is symbolic as much as anything else, is that, you know, essentially what you see in the Labour period is all these civil servants coming back from the colonies, and they proceed to colonise their own country. Because until then, I mean, you'll have come across William Bulpett, you know, and his whole argument is that there's this dual polity until at least the 40s. It starts to break down a bit earlier than that, but the 45 is really when it collapses. There's this historical separation between this realm of high politics, foreign policy, defence, wars, all the rest of it, and then the sphere of kind of local governance, public services, poverty, all the rest of it, which really historically was done in the shires.
Yes.
And it was the squirearchy followed by the county councils. And his point is that, you know, you have in England for a very long period of time this government which is essentially a fairly homogenous class of aristocrats coming together in London through a whole series of kind of structured social events, often tied to the monarchy. And, you know, that's how government works. They come together in London for the season, they talk, then they go back to the shires and they run the country. And in 45, that really collapses. And suddenly central government is interested in stuff, you know, like local hospitals, that previously it never really took a great interest in. So, yeah, I think there is a real sense in which, you know, what Labour does in tandem with the civil service is it sends out the Whitehall bureaucrats to colonise Britain in a way it never really had been before.
And you start the book, I think, with a statement that centralism is a big experiment that has, you know, has run its course, has essentially failed. Why is that? It was doing some good in the past, but that period seems to have ended.
Well, I guess the first point about calling it an experiment, I mean, I use that term very carefully because it's not that old. You know, the current nature of centralism, we seem to assume it's always been the case in our national dialogue, and that somehow devolution is profoundly odd and unnatural.
Yeah.
But, you know, you only have to go back to 1989 to see local government raising about half of its own money, which is more than it, you know, well, actually it'll raise 100% soon.
Yeah.
But, you know, you only have to go back to 1989 to find a system which actually looked fairly normal in international comparison. So, you know, really, we're talking about a system which certainly until the later 70s, and arguably into the late 80s, was internationally not that odd. So really, we're talking about maybe 30 years. Now, you know, I don't think we entered into that experiment because someone sat down and planned it all out and said central control is better. You know, I think we entered into it because of a whole load of political choices and conflicts, particularly the battle between Thatcher and the new urban left. I think it's run its course, well, partly just because I don't think there's anywhere else for it to go, as I said earlier. Yep. You know, you go back to 2010. I suppose you could have centralised social care if you really wanted to, but what else was there?
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't centralise anymore without just giving up on the idea of local government entirely.
Yeah.
But I think fundamentally you have to look at the outcomes that centralism's delivered. You know, so what do people claim about centralism? Now, I think one of the points I make in the book is it's actually very hard to find anyone who will defend centralism. You know, it's something which people do because it's convenient, not because, I mean, you know, with the exception of probably David Walker, you know, there are very few people who are prepared to say centralism is a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Even Tony Blair didn't say he was a centralist.
No.
But, you know, you look at the claims it makes. It's supposed to make us more equal, and yet it hasn't. You know, if anything, we've become less equal since we started introducing it. Now, there are a whole load of factors involved in that, but if centralism is so wonderful, if it is such a driver of equality, why have we become less equal as a society during the period of that experiment?
Absolutely.
You know, I think there are lots of statistics like that which show you that, you know, centralism has delivered on its promises. We've centralised housing policy more and more over the last 30 years. You know, has it meant that we've built more houses? You know, in fact, what we've seen is governments continually flailing to try and find ways to get an oligarchical market to build more and more properties, which it seems completely unwilling to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I've kind of come to the reluctant conclusion, the only way we'll ever solve this is to give local authorities the ability to build again.
Yeah.
That's the only time we've come anywhere near to building 250,000 units a year.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good example. I think if you look at the NHS, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear that the only way that we'll put healthcare on a sustainable basis is to create much more localized community-based systems of healthcare that treat people in the community, that keep them well,
yeah.
that keep them out of hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, a nationally run system, which is fundamentally based around clinical care, isn't going to do that.
No.
And we talked about the health inequalities earlier. You know, they are scandalous.
Yeah.
So I just think, you know, if you look at any of the claims you might make for centralism about the way that it tackles poverty, inequality,
yeah.
That it's more efficient even. You know, there's lots of evidence in the book that it's not efficient. One example I use is around machinery of government changes. One of the things that centralism does is it gives you, as a prime minister, huge scope to tinker with Whitehall to signal changes. And, you know, we saw under Blair and Brown just hyperactive reorganisation of central government departments.
Yes.
I think in one case there was a health agency which was actually abolished about 3 months before it was due to be actually set up. And it costs a lot of money. I mean, I did a very kind of superficial scan of NAO reports.
Yeah.
And we're looking at hundreds of millions of pounds spent just on kind of rearranging the deck chairs in Whitehall.
Yeah.
You know, now if you compare that with what they do in, say, the States, you find much more stable sets of departments, much less reorganisation, much more adaption within the existing system. So I just think, you know, the problem here is we've given centralism 30 years to see if it works. I'm struggling to see any criteria you could set for centralism that it's actually delivered on.
No, quite. I think one of the points you talk about in the book, and it's one of those themes, I think, that runs throughout, is not... You've talked about centralism and its failure from a public services point of view, but you're also very critical about centralism as a philosophy and the way it denudes the public space and the community space at the local level. It doesn't encourage autonomy and...
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, if we have a world in which, you know, what centralism's promise is essentially, if you boil it down politically, is it's a Thatcher or a Blair or a Brown standing up and saying to the people of the country... These local people that you elect and these bureaucrats who run your local public services, they're useless.
Mm.
In fact, at best they're useless. At worst, they might actually be trying to get one over on you.
Yeah.
I am the only person you can trust.
Yeah.
Me and my government. And we've got civil servants. We know what's happening. We can fix it. We will make it right. Mm. Vote for us and we'll sort out those people who aren't doing a good job locally for you. And I think that's hugely corrosive of a sense of public and civic responsibility.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we have created, particularly under the Blair era, where we sort of said, you're a consumer of public services, you have rights to public services. We created an era in which we almost explicitly said to the public, it's fine for you to be very passive and for you to expect us to sort it out for you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make it better. Now, you know, if you can pull that off, then brilliant. The problem is we can't. Again, what we learned under the Blair period is that we actually need the public. If we want to deliver really good public service outcomes, mm-hmm. we need the public to be much more actively engaged.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you then bring that back to where we are now with austerity, you know, and we can't afford a consumer model of public services anymore.
No.
You know, not only can we not deliver it, now we actually can't afford it. We can't even afford to pretend that we can do it. So, you know, if I look at what's happening to local government, which is the area I know best, you know, we are going to see over the next 5 years quite substantial swathes of public services having to be scaled back quite dramatically. And we're going to see local authorities becoming much more like emergency services.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of social care, in children's services, it'll be about the bits of the council that take the kids into care. That will have plenty of money. Well, we'll have plenty of money, but that will be the bit we concentrate on.
Yeah.
There'll be much less prevention.
Mm.
Similarly, in adults, you know, we're going to see much more of a focus on the people who need help the very most.
Yes.
Less of that kind of community work, less of that preventative work. Now, you know, that's not an acceptable outcome for me, that we just kind of scale back the local state. And we have this set of etiolated public services. What I really want to see is a world in which, yes, we have a smaller state, but we also have a smaller private sector, a smaller market. And what we're able to do in the middle is capitalise on, I think, what's a real surge at the moment in social activity, in the social economy, in the cooperative sector, in terms of new technology, enabling people to do things voluntarily.
Mm.
I think one of the huge trends we're seeing at the moment is that technology... and associated social attitudes that go with it, is creating a much more DIY ethic among the public. I think there's a much greater demand for people to take more control over their areas, their lives. So, you know, very small piece of evidence, but the cooperative movement has surged over the last few years.
Indeed.
You know, about a 26% increase in the number of co-ops.
Yeah.
So, you know, I talk in the book about this idea of commonism. And what I really mean is, you know, there's lots of different language for this. I use the language of commons because I think it's quite powerful.
Mm.
But I think this idea of kind of a world in which there's a smaller facilitating state, there's a strong market, but in the middle, there's this kind of much bigger, vibrant realm of not-for-profits, cooperatives, groups taking over parks, people looking after their neighbours. I think there are a whole load of trends in the economy and society which will drive the creation of that much bigger social space. And, you know, if a smaller state leads to a bigger civic commons that can compensate for some of that,
yeah.
I actually think that's better, because I think that involves us more. It gives us more of a sense of, as individuals and as communities, more of a sense of fulfilment. We're not just the passive recipients of government largesse.
No.
We're people who are doing things for ourselves, shaping our own places, shaping our own cities.
And in the book, you use examples not only from the UK, and you talked about the cooperative movement, and I think you referenced some of the energy projects that we've now, you know, we see happening up and down the country. But you also use examples from many different countries as well, in the sense that this point that this isn't just happening, it's not just a British experience, this is actually a global experience in many respects. Just say a little bit more about that, how that's playing out in different countries, and the examples that you were, you know, that you were drawn to.
Yeah, well, I think the trends that are driving it in Britain are driving it elsewhere as well. I think the technology, the changing social attitudes that go along with it. The fact is, you know, today I can download all of the world's music for an £8 subscription.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't do that 20 or 30 years ago. If I really want to, I can print out a gun on a printer at home and go and shoot someone with it. The world is changing. I have a lot more power and autonomy now than I would have had 20 or 30 years ago. There's a lot more information and knowledge available to me. So, yeah, I think England in particular dramatises this kind of tension between the networked individual, the empowered individual, and the empowered community versus the increasingly clunky mechanism of the central state.
Mm.
But you're right, it's happening everywhere. This tension is happening across the world. Two examples that I thought were quite powerful. One was from New York when Superstorm Sandy hit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was a catastrophe. You know, I think something like 50 or 60 people died. The economy was hit very badly. Huge amounts of property was destroyed.
Yeah.
And in some of the outlying parts of New York, people were left without power for a very long time. And FEMA, the federal agency that was supposed to cope with this, was doing a very bad job.
Mm.
In fact, at one point, FEMA closed its branch offices because the winds were too high. Now, what's fascinating about this is that, you know, there is the state's leaving a gap here, the state's failing people. And what steps into that gap, of all things, is the Occupy movement. Now, you know, everyone remembers them from Zuccotti Park and all the rest of it.
Yep.
But actually, they've turned themselves into a sort of social work organisation now. And in this case, you have a bunch of occupiers who basically start posting messages on Facebook saying they want to go out to the Rockaways, this kind of coastal part of New York, to go and help people. And they basically, some of them drive out to a church out on the outskirts of New York and try and set up a kitchen. And they start kind of putting up messages on Facebook asking for support. They're hoping to mobilise perhaps 40 or 50 volunteers. And this thing explodes. And it's this kind of, it's this anarchist disaster relief operation. It just comes out of nowhere. More and more people start turning up and volunteering. They get a local church. They then overflow that local church and move into another one.
Yeah.
Anyone who turns up, they're invited to bring cars, supplies. And they're kind of roughly organised to go out and do things. They get doctors turning up. So they get the doctors to go and provide people with medical help. With their prescriptions, which, you know, the kind of the hospital doctors formally can't do because of their insurance, but these volunteers are going off and doing it. They set up lists on Amazon of things that they need and get donations. You know, so they've got huge amounts of kind of food coming in. They've got people across the world buying stuff on Amazon and posting it to these churches.
Yeah.
And it turns into this extraordinary kind of self-organized disaster relief operation. Now, the really weird thing about this is that when I was writing the book, I was looking for case studies of this. And the best case study is by the US Department for Homeland Security, which is kind of creepy, right? But they were looking at it because they were thinking, well, hang on. Yeah, there's something weird happening here. You know, this hasn't happened before.
No.
And for them, you know, they wanted to understand, how do we tap into this kind of community capacity? And for me, it's a prime example of the way that self-organized community activity, okay, in special circumstances, a disaster is unusual, but that kind of activity can step in and fill a huge gap the state wasn't filling.
Yeah.
So that's a really good example. I mean, a more organised one that I use in the book is Bologna. And again, Bologna, slightly special case. I mean, Bologna has been, it's a very organised left of centre politics for a very long time. It's got a huge cooperative sector.
Indeed, yeah.
But Bologna is the only place I've found so far that's really made a concerted effort to shift from sort of doing public services to doing the commons. And this really started off, there's a lawyer I spoke to. Italy has a very legal culture.
Yeah.
And he'd been to the States and kind of seen the emerging commons movement there. And he goes back to Bologna, and they started by creating a load of community projects, getting people to take over things like crumbling arches and to look after them and to clean up their local areas. And what became clear after a while was that you could get all this local community stuff working, people looking after assets, but there were all sorts of legal barriers and bureaucratic barriers. So, again, peculiarly Italian thing, but this guy actually framed a law that cities across Italy are now adopting en masse, which was about, you know, how do you actually handle the commons? What are the rules of engagement? And so actually now you're starting to see this very kind of formal adoption of the idea of the public having a much bigger role, certainly in the public realm. And I think that's quite exciting. Mm. You know, I think there are those examples. You can see them on a smaller scale in Britain. You know, so you know, you go to Lambeth, for instance, and the council is helping people form community groups to take over parks. Mm-hmm. That's just like a small thing, but actually it's quite hard to do sustainably. And parks are one of those services which are going to get very, very badly affected by the cuts.
Indeed.
So, you know, I look
and you've got a great you've got a great one in the book as well about how we see much more imaginative use now of some of our library space and the movement around that, which I thought was fantastic as an example in the book as well.
Well, the Common Library is great, and this also, I mean, what I like about the Common Library example is that it also speaks to the fact this isn't just about kind of keeping public services going. No. It's about transforming what a public service is about.
Bringing them about, making them more relevant for, you know, greater portions of the society and of the community that they're trying to serve. Yeah.
So, I mean, very, very briefly, I mean, it's this lady called Anne-Marie Naylor, who is this slightly mad but rather brilliant woman who goes around sort of creating these, you know, high-tech, commons-based public services. And basically, she took over an abandoned bus shelter and she created what she calls a common library in there. And the essential idea of a common library is that, you know, a library is a place we go to read stuff other people have written.
Mm.
And for her, that wasn't good enough. You know, in the age of the internet, she thought, well, people don't want just to go and kind of read stuff other people have produced. They want to create themselves. And so what she did was kind of get all these tools. You know, there was a big old printing press. There was loads of sort of electronic kit there. And she created basically a sort of a hack space.
Mm.
And she ran classes and she had kind of clubs of people who wanted to come in and tinker with technology. And the kind of the iconic product of this was the MakerBox. And basically the MakerBox, this is based on the rule of the place, was you could come and use it. The only rule was if you made something there, you had to leave behind the instructions. And so basically, you know, what the MakerBox is it's the instructions for something someone's made there. And the instructions are always free.
Mm.
And you can buy the components and take it off and make it.
Mm-hmm.
And these are now being exported around the country.
Yeah.
They're kind of brilliant. But it's a lovely example of taking a library, something which, you know, but don't get me wrong, I love libraries. Libraries are wonderful. I use them loads as a kid. I love books and knowledge. But it was taking that idea of a library as this very passive experience, which is so symbolic of the way we view public services in this country.
Yeah.
And saying, no, it's not that. It's an active experience. And it's an active experience that creates shared wealth and knowledge. And, you know, it's a small experiment, but it's being scaled now by local authorities.
Yeah.
And I just think it's such a lovely example of what I mean by kind of commonism. It's about taking something which 5 or 10 years ago we'd have seen as something I consumed, and instead turning me into someone who's making something and contributing.
So powerful. Yeah. I want to turn to one of the things I liked about the book was it wasn't just, in some respects, I read it and there was a sort of historical essay element to it. There was a sort of philosophical treatise element to it. But there was very definitely a call to action theme and sort of ethos in the work. And then actually a plan for action as well, which I thought was really good. So almost take us back to where we were. Given, you know, we are still a relatively centralised country, although, you know, the recent devolution movements that we've been involved in, you've been involved in over the last 4 or 5 years, I think are beginning to unpick some of that, and hopefully we, you know, say more about that. But given where we are now, how does the agenda that you think we ought to be involved in and progress in, how do we start to make that real? How do we go from those brilliant examples and scaling them up, but actually making sure that they're not just, they don't stay as examples, that there's something more systematic and systemic about the change that we want to see?
Well, I mean, I think the devolution agenda, which, you know, both of our organisations talk about endlessly, that's the kind of necessary first step.
Yeah.
Technocratic and imperfect, though it is, getting more power out of Whitehall and down to the level of cities, shires, is the first step. And that's important because it brings power closer to people, to a place where they can actually influence it. And crucially, it brings economic power closer to people. You know, we can now have a debate about the future shape of Greater Manchester's economy, which is actually a realistic debate. It has some power to do something about it, rather than just hoping that London will sort it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important, but I think that's only the beginning. And I guess, you know, for me, devolution is the launch pad for something much broader. And in the book, I call that communism. It's this kind of idea that I guess it's a sort of libertarian socialism in the sense that what it says is, you know, I want a world in which there are good public services, in which there is welfare, in which people are supported. But I want that to be a world that doesn't rely on a gigantic national state. Mm-hmm. And I want that to be a world in which public services, welfare are a liberating force in our lives. And at the moment, I don't think they are.
No,
okay. I think welfare in particular is an extremely bossy, top-down source of stress and anxiety in most people's lives who use it.
Yeah.
So step number one, I mean, let's start with welfare. I think we need to radically change the welfare state to put more power in people's hands. Mm-hmm. One of the ideas I talk about in the book, which I think is being taken more seriously at the moment, is the idea of a universal basic income.
Indeed.
So, you know, let's put a certain amount of money in everyone's hands every year just for being a citizen.
Yeah.
Let's basically abolish DWP because we'd hardly need it and save that money. And why is that important? Well, in itself it's important because it empowers me as an individual. You know, it gives me a bit more flexibility to leave a bad job or leave a bad partner or take a bit of a risk in my life.
Yeah.
So I think that's really powerful just in itself. But in terms of communism, you know, what I'm asking for is a world in which we are all contributing more to our shared civic life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's really hard at the moment because we all have to work very hard. We've all got lots of commitments. You know, we don't have the time and space to contribute that much.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who do are brilliant and heroic. But wouldn't it be better if all of us had the ability, if we wanted to free up some of our time to contribute more to civic life, mm-hmm. to help an elderly neighbour, to contribute to a local amenity group, to look after a park, to do something we care about that's actually fulfilling for us. So changing welfare around is really important because that liberates us and it creates more free time that people can use to contribute, to do things they care about that make life better. I think we've got to think about democracy in here. I mean, I talk in the book about the idea of a democracy of doing. You know, I think actually just doing, contributing, looking after things around us, I think that is a democratic act, and I think we need to reframe it that way. But we are going to have to do something about formal democracy as well. I think councillors are heroes. I think they're brilliant. They give a lot of time for very little reward towards governing communities. But there are too many parts of the country which are one-party states where the public doesn't really get a look in, where all the politics happens within a ruling Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat group. And I don't think that's acceptable. You know, so part of that, I think, is that we need to introduce e-democracy a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
No one's got that right yet. But if you look at places like Athens, places like Reykjavik, we've got examples coming through of how e-democracy can actually let the public put ideas onto the agenda for the people who run local authorities. But the other idea I talk about is selection of councillors by lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think all of them, of course not, but I think, you know, a good proportion, maybe a quarter of councillors, should be selected by lottery from anyone who wants to stand, who meets basic criteria. You know, you probably shouldn't be a criminal or insane. You know, but I think what that does is it means that even on a council that has a solid Labour or Conservative or whatever majority, they've always got to negotiate. And it actually means that ordinary people have more of a voice. And then in terms of actually building that realm, that kind of realm of the civic commons, there's quite a complicated idea in there, but it amounts to looking at what happens in the States and how they do it there. And essentially, if you look at places that do this well in the States, what you tend to have is quite a lot of urban philanthropy going on.
Yep.
You have foundations which can invest in the development of voluntary and social enterprise types of services. So my argument is that what we need to do is basically capitalise kind of basically urban funds to invest in the commons. That's not that crazy an idea. There's one being set up in West London, which isn't a million miles away from what I'm describing. And actually that fed into some of my thinking in the book. You know, it is kind of being done already. So you create a fund which can actually start to invest in innovation, in new social enterprises, in new business models, which can start to do useful things in the public services space. And you bring the public sector into that, so the public sector commissioning strategies are set up in such a way that they can encourage people to develop new ideas, knowing they'll get picked up by the state and supported. So it's trying to create a virtuous cycle. It's based on something called collective action methodology, which is quite popular in parts of the state. It basically says, let's get business, let's get the community sector, let's get the public sector all together. Let's agree on the outcomes we care about. And then let's invest in trying new things that might hit those and use public money to scale up the ones that work. So it's really about creating a social innovation system for each one of the UK's great cities.
Fantastic. And one of the issues I think was quite interesting in the book, and you've just touched on it then, is the public's involvement and, you know, the requirement for popularisation almost of the devolution movement. so far actually has been criticized for being a technical or technocratic process. Almost, you know, devolution is still regarded as a top-down process. Just say a little bit around that and your concerns about that and how we might deal with some of those issues. We are both advocates of the mayoral system, for particularly for our bigger cities, but equally we've been criticised that they're anti-democratic or undemocratic. What's the relationship there?
Well, I mean, I'm a fan of mayors because I think if you're going to put a load of power at the level of a combined authority, then, you know, democracy for me demands that I know who I can sack if I don't like what the combined authority is doing.
Mm.
And, you know, the idea that in Greater Manchester, that combined authority is accountable to me because 10 council leaders meet.
Yeah.
That doesn't do it for me.
No.
So I think in that case, democracy does demand a figure I can identify and sack if I don't like what they're doing. But I think the problem with devolution is that, you know, essentially we've got devolution from an elite in Whitehall to an elite in Manchester or Leeds or, you know, Newcastle or wherever else.
Yeah.
And for the public, a lot of the time, the kind of the idea of a Greater Manchester combined authority feels about as remote as Whitehall does.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't see a lot of difference in their daily lives. That doesn't mean it's not a good idea, quite the opposite. You know, as I think I've already said, devolving more power to cities at that level is an excellent idea for all sorts of reasons. But if it stops at the level of the combined authority and the mayor, then I think that's probably a huge missed opportunity.
Mm.
You know, so the opportunity for me is to say, right, how do we take that devolution of power and use it to have a different sort of conversation with local people?
Yeah.
How do we have a conversation about how democracy in our cities works? About accountability, about the role the public play. You know, how do we have a conversation with the voluntary sector about how they can step up and play a role in shaping the urban economy?
Yeah.
For me, I think, you know, if you look at this from a Labour perspective, somewhere like Manchester, the opportunity here is surely to take on more power from Whitehall and then do things your way to kind of hack George Osborne's agenda to do something progressive.
Yeah.
I think the only way you can really do that is to say to the people of Manchester, you know, this isn't just about councillors, this is about you as well. Come and help us hack the city. Come and help us make something better out of this set of powers we've got.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly what that looks like. No. I suspect it probably starts with some form of constitutional convention. It has to be some form of structured discussion.
Yeah.
But I think it really needs to be a very open discussion between the political leaders of the city and the people of the city and the civil society institutions of the city about how democracy should work and about how everyone gets behind transforming the economy and the social fabric of those cities.
Yeah. We begin to come to a close shortly. So I'm curious as to whether you think, because in the book, you very well make this point that nearly all national politicians, particularly when they're not in government, say that when they get into government, they're going to give power away. And when they get into government, they very rarely give power away. So I wonder whether, you know, the movements and the changes and the trends that you've outlined, you see as somewhat unstoppable and inevitable. You know, they may take longer, but actually this will happen. Or are there certain things that we really still need to address and tackle? Are there, you know, there are obstacles, barriers in Whitehall or anywhere else that could actually derail or stop or reverse, you know, this process? Because in some sense it feels almost inevitable, but I think that is often very rarely the case, is it, I think?
It does feel like a juggernaut at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's great. But yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, I was genuinely taken by surprise by how far and how fast George Osborne's gone on this. And things that happen that hard and fast can probably be reversed just as quickly, you're right. I think, and it's certainly the argument I make in the book, that there are a whole load of trends which are driving us in the direction of decentralisation. You look at the fragmentation of British politics at the moment, the kind of collective nervous breakdown we seem to be having around everything from Europe to the Labour Party to the nature of the Conservative Party, Scotland. You know, our faith in the ability of politicians to make our lives better is very low at the moment. There's clearly a sense that, you know, the North has a very different set of challenges to the South.
Yeah.
That Wales and Scotland have very different challenges. We are kind of pulling apart a bit as a nation, and I think that's got to make a very strong central state much harder to maintain. And that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we should never have tried to put everyone under the single umbrella of such a powerful London-based government.
Yeah.
So we're sort of correcting that at the moment through this political nervous breakdown. But then you just look at technology, you look at the kind of, I mean, Paul Mason talks about the kind of the networked individual. I mean, in his world, the networked individual is the agent of the eventual Marxist revolution.
Yeah, no, quite.
And I'm not sure I take it that far. But there clearly is something happening in the labour market. You know, the RSA says that by 2025, there might well be more people who are self-employed than working in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a world which is becoming more fragmented, more individualist, where I can do more for myself, where, you know, the idea of the gig economy is becoming quite powerful. So I think we're seeing a world in which big institutions of all sorts are under suspicion, where we're questioning their motives, their efficacy, and, you know, where at the same time we're seeing a resurgence of the small, the local, the specific. Not in a way that I think is parochial, because I think these organisations are globally connected by the internet. But in a way which says, you know, so like, probably the best way to put it, there's a quote from Richard Florida I use in there, which I really like. And he sort of says that, in a sense, the city is to the 21st century what the factory was to the early 20th. And, you know, what's a factory? It's a building in which we kind of bring a whole load of factors of production together. And, you know, at one end, a load of goods come in, and at the other end, a load of stuff comes out and we go and sell it. It's this self-contained unit of production. And in a sense, the kind of the white-hot agglomerations of Manchester, Leeds, London, are the equivalent of that now. The factory is not a building in which a load of people go and work in a way someone tells them. The factory is an urban core where lots of people freely interact all the time. What bubbles up to the surface is frequently hugely valuable, productive knowledge work. And in a world where the unit of production isn't really the nation state anymore, but it's perhaps seven or eight agglomerations which are very geographically specific, can we maintain the kind of government, the kind of regional economic policies we've had for the last 20 or 30 years? I don't think so.
A perfect note on which to finish. Simon Parker, thank you very much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.